On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
There have been a lot of very tumultuous times in the United States history, but of all the ones that did not directly revolve around a global conflict or a global recession or depression, perhaps the most tumultuous time in American history occurred during the lifetime of many of our listeners, including yours truly, the 1960s. Here to talk to us about his reflections of an enormous number of things that happened during the 1960s to which he was either an eyewitness or directly involved with is Fry Gillard, who is a writer in residence at the University of South Alabama and the John Egerton Scholar in Residence at the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi. He's author of more than 20 books and the winner of the Lillian Smith Award, the Clarence Kasin Award for Nonfiction, and most recently the 2016 Eugene Current Garcia Award for Distinction in Literary Scholarship. His latest book is A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. It's available from New South Books. Fry is a native of and resident of Mobile, Alabama. Fry, thank you so much for making time to be with us on the Bookshelf.
I'm glad to be here, and thanks for having me. It's an interesting time to reflect on. We live in a tumultuous time now, and some of it may resonate. Some of the reflections on the 60s may resonate with people in terms of what we're dealing with now in terms of division in the country and those kinds of things. But anyway, it was good to go back and consider those times that were kind of my coming of age decade.
When the decade began in the 1960s, I was 7 years old. You were a little older than that.
I was in junior high school, so okay. I was in the eighth grade, I guess, whatever that makes me, 13 right. Maybe when it started, something like that. Yeah.
A little more aware of things probably than I would be as a seven-year-old.
A little bit. I was fairly clueless when it started, but that changed quickly. I remember one of my early memories of the decade was in January of 1961, when my homeroom teacher turned on the black and white TV that she had brought for us to watch so we could see John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. We saw on that flickering black and white screen him saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And even as kids, we knew that this was kind of exciting and stirring. And if we had any doubts when the speech was over, our teacher turned to us and she looked at us and she said, I just love things like this. And it was kind of a little bit of a wake up to students to say, pay attention to the world around you. Exciting things are apt to be happening. And they were. It was early 60s were a time when a lot of people were convinced that they could make a great country even greater. John Kennedy stirred those hopes. So did civil rights protesters in Alabama and other places. Young people dressed in their Sunday finest going to sit in at lunch counters asking not to be denied service because of the color of their skin. It was an exciting time that got more so.
I think one of my earliest really sentient things about being in the 1960s, I remember reading in Weekly Reader, the little periodical that was for elementary school children, about our new president, John F. Kennedy, and how he read. It was ridiculous, like 20,000 words a minute or something. And I was very impressed by this as a little kid because I knew I loved to read, but I thought, wow, I don't know, reading that fast, that's just incredible. When Kennedy was shot, for whatever reason, I was in the fifth grade, and my fifth grade teacher had turned on the radio for us to hear the motorcade from Dallas. And so there we were listening to it. She never turned it off until we got the word that he had died, and she wept. And this was a big, tough woman. And I think for me, it was kind of like with you 3 years earlier, when you see your teacher reacting to things, not just as a teacher, but as a person, as a citizen, it has a huge impact on you as a student.
I think that's absolutely right. And I was in high school by then, and I had similar experience. I was walking down the hall, and a kid that I knew came running past and said, K, Kennedy's been shot. And I thought he was joking. And when he made it clear that he was not, I rushed down to the office where I knew there was a principal's office where I knew there was a TV. And there were men and women who were part of our faculty staring at the screen, looking stricken, and a couple of them were shedding tears. And, you know, the gravity of it was just so apparent right there. You just couldn't believe that this was happening in our own country to a person who had stirred such hopes. And we know now that he was a flawed person as well and had his own feet of clay, but he did have the ability to inspire. And he was our president, and somehow the fact that this could happen certainly represented a loss of some of our innocence that we felt as a country.
Oh, yeah. First of all, who are these people? How dare they kill our president? And second of all, on some level, you start to realize if the president of the United States is not safe with all the security there is around him and all the people and everything else, then none of us are either. And once again, that's a loss of innocence.
Yes, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that was one of the things that happened during this very difficult time.
The civil rights movement, being an Alabamian, I grew up in Central Florida. And amazingly enough, even though there was stuff going on, it was never reported in the newspapers. I had no idea that Dr. King went down to St. Augustine to help organize the garbage workers and things like that. It was never reported in our newspapers. In Alabama, it had to be, this was one of the real crucibles for the civil rights movement, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi. And you write about the freedom riders coming through and that's pretty horrible to hear about it. And it must've been even more difficult because here you are, it's your state and you have these ideals that this is a great thing that's happening. And instead it's being attacked by adults in your state.
Yeah, it was the Freedom Rides in 1961 were really horrifying. And even to those of us who were young and our racial views were not fully formed yet, we're still in a state of transition from being, you know, comfortable with the segregated order of things to being uncomfortable with that and finally thinking that we need to do better and we need to build a more just society. I was kind of in the middle of rethinking what I'd been raised with and was still very young, and so I didn't quite know how to go about that. But it didn't take much imagination to realize that it was just wrong and horrifying for grown people, white people, to attack a Greyhound bus and set it on fire and try to burn the people inside it alive.
Yeah.
Because there were black people and white people traveling together from one state to another. I mean, that's really what happened. It wasn't even civil disobedience. It was legal for them to do this, to travel in integrated groups. And yet, when they crossed the state line and they were attacked in Anniston, Alabama, and again in Birmingham, and again in Montgomery, you know, there were people trying to kill them for just riding a bus. And that was so horrifying that it pushed some of us in more in the direction of rethinking the racial understandings that we've been raised with.
Oh, yeah. I can remember very distinctly watching what was going on in Birmingham in 1963 and seeing children my age, who just happened to be black, being attacked by police dogs and hit by fire hoses, wielded not to stop a fire, but to encourage them to quit protesting an unjust system. And in my little naive heart, I thought, there's something wrong with this. And all I'd ever known was segregation, too. It seemed like just the way things always had been. And like you, I began to think, maybe this isn't the way they always need to be.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, one of the things about the book that I've written about the 60s is that it, in some ways, is very much a Southern point of view, because that was the reality of my life. But
yeah.
I don't think I overstated the importance of events in the South to the whole country. You know, I think Birmingham in 1963, first of all, the fire hoses and dogs, the courage of those young people, the eloquence of Martin Luther King, then the Birmingham church bombing later that year was so horrifying, and George Wallace's stand in the schoolhouse door in the summer of 1963. All of that led President Kennedy to introduce civil rights legislation and to make this very powerful televised speech to the country about civil rights. And, you know, it confronted the country with the fact that we had some problems that we had not dealt with. And that awareness spread to other parts of society. You know, soon you had women's voices being raised about unequal pay for the same work. You had Betty Friedan in 1963 writing a book called The Feminine Mystique about how women lived circumscribed and unfulfilled lives too often in the United States. And 3 years later, she and some of her colleagues organized the National Organization for Women. And you also had Rachel Carson, a young scientist in 1962, writing Silent Spring about the impact of chemicals and pesticides on our environment, and beginning with her words to encourage an environmental movement. And you had, poorer labor groups, from garbage workers in St. Augustine to Memphis to farm workers in California, beginning to protest for better wages and safer working conditions and those kind of things. So there was a lot of ferment, people demanding that we do better, and many of us who were more fortunate but believed along with them that we could do better. But, of course, there was the other side, too, that change is frightening to a lot of people. And then hanging over all of it by 1965 was the war in Vietnam and the divisions that went with it, the loss of life that went with it, the loss of innocence that went with it, because we began to doubt after a while the wisdom of the policy that was sending our young men to risk their lives and, in some cases, lose their lives. And, you know, we began to realize the death toll of Vietnamese was staggering, more than 1 million before it was over. So, those kinds of things were part of the decade, too. And then I also try to write about the cultural things that we experienced, from music to movies to, visual art, literature. Because all of that was what kind of assaulted our senses and made us realize what a vibrant time we were living in.
Really, it's a mosaic approach. Even though you do the book in chronological order, you talk about what's happening in each of those distinct parts of that era. And there was so much going on. The music of the 1960, say, is so very different. And the different things it went through, from doo-wop to folk to the Beatles and the British Invasion, the Beach Boys, rock and roll getting harder and harder, jazz rock, all these things, the importance of Motown, all of these cultural are going along during the 1960s. And it gives us a place to kind of hang on to and say, well, I remember when this was a popular song, or our children and grandchildren go, what was all that about? What was the eve of destruction about? And so it's, again, a reason that it's worth to for us to reevaluate the 1960s and to figure out what lessons can we learn from them. We're talking, in case you've just joined us, to Fry Gilyard, who is the author of A Hard Rain, America and the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost, from New South Books. Available through your favorite local or online retailer, and which makes it pretty much available everywhere. Let's talk about some of the people with whom you had direct contact. And not only do you talk about people that were influential in the culture, but you also talk about people that you actually got to meet, such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., such as Bobby Kennedy.
Right. The first person that I of great historical import that I ever encountered was probably Dr. King. I was a junior in high school in 1963, growing up in Mobile, and we went on a high school field trip to Birmingham. And we got to Birmingham we were there on Good Friday, 1963, and Dr. King was arrested that day, and a small group of us happened to walk out of our hotel where we were staying and just kind of stumbled upon the arrest of this man that we had heard of, that we had been warned about, that our parents were afraid of, and
right.
thought he was trying to destroy the Southern way of life and these kinds of things. And there was this sort of smallish man. Dr. King was maybe 5'7", I think, not tall. He was wearing jeans and a denim shirt, and he was being arrested by two Birmingham policemen and kind of pushed roughly up the sidewalk, and we could see the look of sadness in his eyes, and for some of us it was kind of a humanizing thing, and the face of change became the face of Martin Luther King, and we didn't quite know what to make of it, but it made an impression that we couldn't quite shake. A few years later, he came to Vanderbilt, where I was a student, and from 64 to 68, and made a talk, and I did get to shake his hand briefly. I wouldn't say I really had any kind of meaningful conversation with him, but I did get a sense of his graciousness and his humility, his courtesy in dealing with his student hosts that day. And then the following year, I had a more extended encounter with Robert Kennedy, who was changed, people who knew him believe, by the death of his brother, by the assassination of President Kennedy in 63. Robert Kennedy, as his younger brother, was thrown into deep grief and then had to redefine his own life and figure out how to make his own mark. And as a U.S. senator, he seemed so viscerally, palpably, clearly to identify with people on the margins, with people who hurt, whether they were Black or Native American or Mexican American or whatever. And yet he wanted to reach out to people on the other side of the racial divide in the country, and including working class white people and the people of Appalachia and West Virginia and others. And try to heal divisions in the country. And so I had a chance to talk with him when he came to Vanderbilt. I actually rode in the car with him from the airport to the campus, mm-hmm. and just had a sense of his depth of conviction about things, at least enough to where it was personal to me when he was killed in June of 1968, a couple of months after the assassination of Martin Luther King. So there was that incredible sadness and despair that many of us felt as the year 1968 progressed through those tragedies.
I have to say, with the possible exception of 2001, that 1968 was the most traumatic year of my life. I was throwing papers. I was in by the fall of 68, I was in high school, and we just couldn't believe that the things were happening, the riots around the country, and the protest had become more violent in places. Certainly the reaction to the continuing murders of eminent political leaders and civil rights leaders in America, it just didn't seem to have any end to it. And the 1968 Chicago Convention, Democratic National Convention in Chicago, that turns into a riot as well. It just seemed like the country was coming apart at the seams.
It really felt that way. You know, you had the mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, yelling anti-Semitic slurs at Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut, who was Jewish, when Ribicoff criticized police brutality by the Chicago police. That was the spectacle inside the convention. And then outside, you had certainly excessive brutality by police, but you also had a lot of taunting of police by demonstrators. And, you know, the anger of the student peace movement, you know, was beginning to turn violent. And the ethical absurdity of a violent peace movement certainly disturbed some people who were part of that movement, but for sure it disturbed and put off and frightened many middle Americans who were like you said, they had the feeling that the country was coming apart at the seams and that privileged young people were part of the problem, not the solution. So it, you know, became a very complicated, turbulent, tumultuous time. Even for those of us who were opposed to the war in Vietnam and in favor of civil rights and racial justice and economic justice and environmental protection and those kind of things, even some of us were increasingly disturbed by, you know, the excesses of people that agreed with us about the those philosophies. So it was turbulent.
Now, at that same time, you have the rise of really radical groups. The Students for Democratic Society had been radical in their own way, but now you have the Weather Underground is developing, which becomes essentially the left wing alternative to the right wing Klan. You had George Wallace emerging, building a political base built on the law and order theme, and his participation in the Democratic Convention, in the primaries and so forth, changes the dynamics of the Democratic Party, and the candidate that they select and so forth. You have all these things going on simultaneously, but the one bright shining light for me through all of this, and I will say this because I was a kid growing up in Central Florida, and we could see all the space launches from our front porch, and the bigger the missile got that it took to send a capsule in space, the bigger the light in the sky would be. And when Apollo went up, the missiles that carried it upwards were huge. And I remember seeing one test flight that went off at night, and it was like the sun came up on the beach. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, that was an amazing thing. And you know, that Alabama played a role in that too, because some of those missiles, they were built in Huntsville and designed in Huntsville, and so that was. And then you know, you had Apollo 8 that went to the moon but did not land in December of 1968, and as they came around from behind the moon, the dark side of the moon, they saw an Earth rise. They saw our planet hanging sort of blue and fragile and beautiful there against the blackness of space. And they took a picture of it, and all of a sudden, all of us could see that we shared this pretty tiny home, really, in the cosmos. And the sense that we needed to take care of it became something kind of palpable. And all these space cowboys who were, you know, daring enough to go into space and go to the moon were move to philosophize about how we shared one Earth and all of those kind of things. So it, you know, there were those kind of lessons that emerged from the decade despite everything. And then, of course, in 1969, Neil Armstrong took, you know, one small step for a man, one great leap for mankind, as we actually, human beings, set foot on the moon. So proving what we could accomplish if we set our minds to it.
Yeah, that was probably the high point of 1969. There certainly were some low points. Ted Kennedy has Chappaquiddick, and here we have another damaged Kennedy brother. And we have the Manson craziness that is beginning in 1969 and will find its fruition in the early 1970s. A pretty tough decade, a great beginning and staggering to a kind of a finally it's over end.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it. So, yeah, thanks for for asking questions based on having read the book. Not everybody does that.
Oh, I can't imagine that. I get this a lot. Part of the fun of doing this is getting to read your book and find out all the interesting things that you saw or that you said. And when you talked about driving Bobby Kennedy around and stuff like that, and the fact that you actually got to sit in a car with one of my still heroes, it's extraordinary. And there's so much more in your book. I mean, we could have talked for a couple of hours to really cover everything well. We kind of jumped around a lot, but there's so much more. Of all the things that we didn't cover, was there one thing in particular that you wanted to mention?
Well, let me think. We talked a little about the music. One of the things I'd like to mention is the important role that Alabama played in the music, particularly the music coming out of Muscle Shoals. It wasn't necessarily as topical as some of the folk protest music, but the fact that you had these great African-American singers like Percy Sledge and Wilson Pickett and others making these wonderful rhythm and blues records, and they were backed by white musicians, and they all knew that they were crossing the racial barrier in this profound way, and they thought they were part of this oasis of brotherhood in northern Alabama. And you know, we kind of learned about that as time went on, and it was just a statement that the state of Alabama made in its own way, that that music reminds us that the things we have in common go deeper than the things that divide us.
Well said, sir. Well said. Our guest today, Ben Fry Gilyard, is the author of A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost, from New South Books. And that is a great way of describing the decade of the 1960s. He is a writer in residence at the University of South Alabama, the winner of the Clarence Kasin Award for Nonfiction Writing, the Lillian Smith Book Award, and the Eugene Current Garcia Award for Distinction in Literary Scholarship. And I want to say thanks again so much, Fry. I really was looking forward to talking to you even before I read your book. But after I read it, I was absolutely determined we'd get a chance to share it with our listeners on the bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And it was a good conversation, and I appreciate your part of it.
Do you have a website or anything that we need to mention?
www.frygilyard.com.
Cool.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, hey, I'm so delighted to get the chance to do it. Hope we get a chance to meet in person someday, too.
I'd love to do that. Let's keep in touch. Okay.
That's a deal. Our thanks again to Fry Gilyard for joining us on the bookshelf today and sharing his incredibly interesting and fascinating book, A Hard Rain, talking about America in the 1960s and what we went through and what we survived. And once again, his website is
www.frygilyard.com.
We didn't have a chance to talk to Fry about his personal interaction with Malcolm X or with singer Linda Ronstadt. If you pick up a copy of the book, you'll be able to read that as well. Please pardon the raspiness of my throat. It's a late winter cold, I'm afraid. Also, check out my Facebook page on the bookshelf on Facebook, and you will get text for book bits that promote various books, but also talk about when a book is coming up that we're going to, whose author we will interview on the bookshelf on the radio. And you can also check our website, WTBFradio.com, to hear this week's interview. It'll start up tomorrow and it'll run the rest of the week. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. God bless.